Thank you for listening to the premiere episode of The Tom Green Interview. I'm Tom Green. Hello, everybody. How you doing? This is exciting. I want to thank Audio Up for the opportunity. This is going to be a lot of fun. My new podcast. I've done podcasts before, but if this is your first time listening to my podcast, welcome. If you've been here in the past, you may have come from various places that I've done shows over the years. MTV, I had a show in 1999 and 2000, and it ran for a few years after that. I did WebOvision, of course, which was my home internet streaming podcast before they were called Podcast back in the early 2000s, where we built a ridiculous television studio in my living room here in Los Angeles, and I interviewed all my friends and made many new friends, and had tons of the top comedians in Los Angeles would pop by and do the show. And it really was one of the truly most creative and exciting experiences I've had since starting the Tom Green Show back in the day on public access TV in Canada, because it was raw, people were authentic, it was in my home, and it was before anybody was doing shows from their home. And it was really interesting to see people come up to the podcast. I'll call it a podcast now, but it was a streaming internet show, and look around and see the cameras and see the microphones and see the desk. And I'd built a little Johnny Carson Tonight Show type set in my living room. And I remember seeing people's wheels turning as mine were at the same time, thinking, wow, yeah, we could do a show in our house and just talk to our friends. And we did hundreds and hundreds, if not thousands, of shows from my living room for a five-year period. The last decade or so, I've been touring the world doing stand-up, and I've really fallen in love with stand-up comedy. And that's what excites me so much about today's show, where I'm thrilled and honored to have one of the greatest stand-up comedians of all time, one of the biggest television stars of all time, from Everybody Loves Raymond, Ray Romano. How cool is that? We're going to talk to Ray and really get into dissecting how stand-up comedy works, how the writing process works, and have a really great conversation with him. I do want to tell you a little bit about what's going on in my life personally before we speak to Ray. I'm about to take off in a van. And when I say take off in a van, I mean move into a van. I'm days away from this. By the time you hear this episode, I may actually be on the road. I'm attempting to give you these weekly podcasts, these weekly episodes of the Tom Green Interview in close to real time. So episode two, it's quite likely, will be recorded from the van. That's right, I'm bringing a studio with me, a state-of-the-art studio. In fact, this studio that I'm talking in right now in my living room, or my guest room, you would call it, in Los Angeles, in my home in Los Angeles, where I did the WebOvision show back in the day. This studio will be coming in the van with me. I've created a compact road case type of carrying device that will allow me to pick up the studio, move it into the van. I'm bringing my microphones, I'm bringing some musical equipment as well, and I'm bringing some cameras, and you'll be able to follow along on my social media as well as here on the Tom Green Interview. So follow me on Instagram at Tom Green, or on Twitter at Tom Green Live, or on my YouTube channel, youtube.com/Tom Green, where I'm going to be documenting the behind the scenes of this podcast and showing you how it's all put together and taking you all to some amazing and beautiful places in America as I travel around this country in 2020 during this strange and bizarre year. I don't want to talk about that too much right now, though. I want to jump into this interview and this conversation I have with the great Ray Romano. Thank you for listening to the Tom Green interview, and tell your friends about it. Tell your friends to subscribe and share this on social media. I appreciate it. Here's Ray. Hello, Ray.
Hey, how are you?
Oh, good. How you doing, Ray? Thanks for calling. I appreciate it. This is I'm excited about this. Thank you very much.
Oh no. Don't be too excited. No. lower your expectations.
No. I'm sure you'll do great, Ray. I'm sure you're going to be great.
Okay.
I don't know if anyone told you, but this is the first episode of my new podcast, the Tom Green Interview, it's called, and we're launching it launching it now with you. So I appreciate you doing me the honor of being my first guest.
I didn't know I was the first one.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Oh, wow. I've done podcasts before, but this is a new one I'm doing with this great podcast company called Audio Up, and we're gonna do a great new show called The Tom Green Interview, where I interview people like yourself, amazing, incredible comedians like yourself. I want to talk a lot about stand up in this show.
All right.
Do you remember, first of all, I was just watching your first appearance on Johnny Carson, and the thing that really popped out for me was how prophetic your first joke was about yeah, cell phones.
Yeah, that's funny.
You open up the show and you talk about how everyone's getting these phones in their cars, and someday they're probably going to even have a phone in their ear, and you know we do have that now, and it was a great bit. But I mean, do you feel that you were sort of you know, are comedians prophetic like that? Do you sort of see the future before it comes?
they might be, but comedians might be, but I'm not. I'm definitely not. By the way, I also predicted in that bit a fax coming out of your ass.
Right,
so
right.
That hasn't happened. I don't think that's going to happen. but it is. Well, it is kind of, yes. It's funny because I have on occasion looked back at that set, and I laugh at, you know, I remember saying, my wife wants a car phone. Like, well, what do we need that for? You know, I think at that time I probably did not have a car. That was 91.
Yeah,
that was November 15th, 1991. I, of course, I remember that date. But you know, I don't know. I don't know if comedians are prophetic. You know, every comedian, you know, has their own thing. They talk about current events, future events, or they do whatever fits them. And for me, it's always been talking about what's going on in my life. You know, I mean, it's just, I guess if you had a label, it's observational, observational family, you know, personal stuff.
When you look at, well, I want to talk about that in detail in a minute, but just a bit more about Carson. When you look at that set, you said you looked at that recently. When you look at that, what goes through your mind when you go back to that day in 1991 when you did your first appearance on Johnny Carson?
I mean, it's a bit, you know, it's a bit emotional to watch it. Just because, well, first of all, Johnny was retiring. He retired, I think, like about 5 months later. And we kind of knew that. And he was, you know, I grew up watching him. And as a comedian, you knew that was the pinnacle. That was it, to be on Johnny. And just the fact that I was getting this chance to reach this dream, and now, you know, now that I've been through everything and I've had this career, I guess, just to look back kind of where it all started and, you know, it's, you know, it sounds like a cliche, but to how innocent I was then and, you know, what a big moment that was for me. Yeah, it makes me emotional. I remember I that afternoon, I was in the hotel. So I was living in New York. So we were in the hotel and the limo was going to come in about an hour to pick me up to take me to the Tonight Show.
Yeah.
And so I went in the shower, and I remember, I just remember saying, "Oh, this is the shower I'm taking to do the Tonight Show."
And yeah.
And I literally got numb.
Uh-huh.
Like for a second, like I couldn't feel my arm in the shower, you know, and I was like, this is bad. You know, it was still like 2 hours away. I'm like, I'm not going to make this, man. and I remember what saved me was we got in the car, me and my manager, and we got in the car and we drove, and I left, like I had a bunch of notes about, I mean, I knew my set, but I still wrote stuff down and the order down and everything. And I left it in the hotel room. So I had him stop the limo, and I ran back about a block and a half to the hotel to get it. And I ran back, and just that physical thing, I just got lucky that I had to get out and run for a block and a half, because that somehow that just calmed me down. I mean, I'm still a nervous wreck.
Yeah.
I'm still a nervous wreck, but I wasn't going to faint anymore.
Cause you know, you get that, that nervous energy. I get that. I know that feeling. And you'd sometimes, you know, taken a little run inadvertently that just kind of alleviated it a bit. I don't think there's nothing really to compare that to today, is there? I mean, young people today might not quite understand what it meant to do Johnny Carson's Tonight Show for a comedian.
It was the biggest thing in the world for me. But even at the time I did it in 91, it wasn't the same as doing it in 1981, you know? Mm. You know, when somebody went on the Tonight Show, I mean, shit, we're going way back. He was on for 35 years, right?
Mm-hmm.
So when somebody went on in the 70s, their career changed overnight, you know? It wasn't quite the same in the 90s, you know, it was 1991, but it was still the stamp, you know, that validation stamp that you were on the Tonight Show with Johnny Carson. Back in the 70s, you did the Tonight Show, and the next day you were making probably five times as much money touring as a comedian as you were then before you did it. It wasn't quite the same in 91, but it's still kind of put you on the map, you know, to have it as a credit. And it was still, personally, for a comedian, it still meant the same, you know. But there was so much comedy on TV at that time back in the 90s.
But just to be able to have made it and gotten to do Carson before the cutoff, before he retired, you know, if it had been a year later, you would have never gotten to do that. So that must be just a great feeling. I noticed he was promoting your upcoming show at Bananas as well. Did you sell out that show?
I probably sold out the early show.
Now,
is that for real? Is that for real?
It was for real. Absolutely. When he introduces you, he's promoting your upcoming show at Bananas. I think it was in Poughkeepsie or something like that.
I remember Bananas. Yeah, I remember that one.
So you were on the you're on the road. You're doing shows. You get Carson. Going back to the first time you got on stage, though, what was that like? I mean, what made you decide you just wanted to do stand-up in the first place?
Well, I was always a fan. I was a fan of stand-up. You know, when a comedian was on Carson, I would make sure I was in the room watching. And I was a fan of comedy. And we had a comedy troupe in my neighborhood in Forest Hills, Queens. This is now during, you know, Saturday Night Live had just started, and we decided to put on our sketch show. So it was me and five other guys, and we called ourselves, we said we'll put on a no-talent show. And we thought we were clever, yeah. And we called ourselves No Talent Incorporated. And we wrote our sketches, we did everything, we were the costume, we were the prop guy, we were everything. And the church, the neighborhood had a teen club every Sunday night that teenagers could go into the basement of the church and play ping pong and hockey, you know, whatever. And they had a stage there. And we decided, we're going to put on a sketch show. And that was my kind of intro to doing any kind of live comedy. And it went pretty good, actually. We would do parodies of guys in the neighborhood, and all the kids, all the teenagers came in. It was a tough crowd, but but they were laughing at themselves, really. but that kind of got me to bug, you know, of getting laughs on stage. And then I had heard about audition night. I was working in a gas station at the time in Forest Hills, and I had heard about somebody had been to an audition night at the Improv.
Yeah.
And I said, oh, what's that like? You know, whatever. And because I had never ventured into Manhattan to go to a comedy club.
Right.
And so I called up the Improv and they told me, yeah, it's the first Sunday of every month. They have one Sunday a month. And, you know, you pick a number out of a hat. You go down on the Sunday afternoon. And if there's, they give out 20 spots. So if there's 40 people there on Sunday afternoon to try to get a spot, they stick 40 pieces of paper in a hat. 20 of them have numbers, 20 of them are blank. You're pulling out of a hat. If you get a number, you go on that night. And I remember this, how much time you got to be on stage? And it's 5 minutes. And, you know, so the first Monday of the month was going to be like 2.5 weeks from now. So I just had 2.5 weeks to get 5 minutes of stuff to say on stage.
Yeah.
And I did it, and it was horrible. it wasn't, by the way, it wasn't, it actually went pretty good.
Yeah.
It actually went pretty, because what tends to happen is, I mean, I don't know how it is now, but they're very generous, those audiences, because they know it's audition night.
Right.
They, you know, normally they're there probably to see another auditioner. So they're pulling for you. So you get a weird kind of curve on your grade. They kind of give you a little more. So they're laughing more than it really is that funny, you know, somewhat. But I remember having, I had a tape of it, and it's some of the material is just horrendous, but it was not bad. They laughed at some of the stuff, you know? So I did get a little taste of getting laughs as a stand-up. And I thought, oh man, this is pretty good. I must be pretty good at this. And this is a story you hear a lot. A lot of guys do have that first night success, and then they find out how wrong they were.
I had that when I was 16 years old. I tried doing stand up for the first time, and I ended up. They called it amateur night at Yuck Yucks in Ottawa.
Yeah,
and I had great first night, and then the next year I bombed every time. But I kind of sometimes. Do you feel like maybe it's because you're naive to the fact that it could go badly? You know, you have enough confidence to think that, oh, I'm funny. This is going to go great. So that first night, you just feel like you can do no wrong. And then
if you do well on that first night, then you really feel on the second night, you feel even more invincible on the second night.
Uh-huh.
And then when you bomb, then it's even a bigger letdown.
Yes.
You know?
Yes. That's what happened
to
me.
And I gave it up for 2 years. I remember.
Oh, really?
You know, once I, I had two runs at it. I had a run. I tried it. And I guess I did it on my second time. I bombed, and I think that's when I gave it up for 2 years. I might have tried it a third time. I'm not sure.
Wow.
And I gave it up for 2 years, and then I tried it again, and gave it up for another year.
Wow.
And it was the third. It was my third attempt when I said I'm gonna stick. You know, I mean, each attempt I had done it like. First time I did it two times, three times. The second time I did it maybe five or six times. And then the third attempt, a year later, I said, you know, I'm going to give it a month, 2 months, whatever. Let's see, you know. And, you know, luckily it stuck.
And when it stuck, when it connected, when you found that rhythm, do you remember what it was that triggered in your head? Like, was it material? Was it comfortability on stage? What was there just something that happened that you said, oh, that's what I need to do?
Well, it's so gradual, but
yeah.
You keep, what I learned was you keep getting better. I remember being, maybe 2 years in, and I heard Jay Leno say in an interview that it takes you 6 years until you really find your voice on stage. And, I was doing it for 2 years. And I was like, what the hell is he talking about? You know, because then later in hindsight, when I looked back, like at 6, 7 years, when I looked back at my, like a tapes I had of 2 years, I was like, he was so right. You know, you just keep, yeah, I mean, it sounds corny, but you find out your voice, you find who you are and what, you know, I didn't choose what to do on stage. I just wrote about what just appealed to me and what came to me. I didn't choose. I didn't say, let me write some political stuff. Let me write some family stuff. I just, you know, I grew up watching, he's not the guy I want to bring up, but I grew up listening to Bill Cosby, you know?
Right. Sure.
And that kind of, family material is what appealed to me. And I didn't choose to write that material. It just was in my, you know, it was in my gene. It was in my wheelhouse of finding the funny. That's where I could find the funny. But it took a while, you know, it took a while to figure out what you're good at, and B, what the audience kind of, you know, it's funny because whenever I come up with a bit now that's kind of dark and dirty, but it's hysterical, and I kind of try to squeeze it in on stage, you know?
Yeah.
I can just tell, like, I can get away with it, you know, 1, 2, 3 times, but I can just feel like, no, I got to give it to Dave Attell.
People just aren't expecting that from you or what is it?
I mean, it just sets them off. I had a bit once. Can we?
Oh yeah. Oh yeah.
Okay. yeah. I mean, it's like me asking, I had a bit once where I was doing about my father driving in the car and how everybody, when he got pissed off, everyone on the road became a hump to him. Everyone he would yell at, you know, look at this hump here, whatever. Uh-huh. And so I did impressions of my father. look at this hump trying to squeeze in on me, you know, whatever, went on and on. Uh-huh. And then he starts yelling at me in the back seat. And you, Mr. Philosophy Major, you know, Mr. $10,000 of my life. Who am I? Why am I here? let me tell you something. You're here because 20 years ago, your mother wouldn't give me a blowjob like I asked for. Okay.
Right.
So I did. So I used to do that. I did it a lot. I did that bit a lot.
Yeah.
And it would kill. It would whatever. It's not, you know, it's not brilliant, but whatever. And one day, you know, do you know Bill Grunfest is? Uh-huh. Bill Grunfest was, he started the Comedy Cellar.
Okay, yeah, yeah.
And he used to run the show and MC. And one night he called me over and he said, listen, I don't like to do this with any comedian, but he said, the bit you do about, you know, your blowjob like this or whatever, he said, you know, you get some laughs, but I feel half the audience kind of move away from you for a little bit.
Uh-huh.
And then you get them back. You always get them back. They always come back to you, you know?
Uh-huh.
But I feel they just move away. And I thought, for a second, I thought, you know, I think he's looking at, he's reading into it too much. He's looking, I don't think I'm seeing that and feeling that. And of course, once he put it in my head,
yeah,
I was more aware of it. And he was kind of right. He was right. It was just, so it was like that. That's what I get, you know, from the audience. They don't, you know, they don't hiss you or whatever. You can just feel when they're not ready for that from you. Now, having said that, I'm not going to let them write my material. You know, when I do my acting now, like when I go to Vegas, I work with me and Spade do Vegas together. Well, not anymore, but
yeah. Well, that's. Hopefully that comes back soon. Yeah, geez.
I know. But I'm saying, you know, I'm people who are expecting the guy from TV, they're not going to get that either. You know, I'm bluer and edgier the guy they know from the TV show, and I'm not going to let them, you know, dictate that I can't do that material. But I kind of have a limit to where I can go with the audience.
Go ahead.
I could push it if I wanted to, but you know, it's not necessary, really.
You sort of feel that, I think you're describing like the energy of the room, right? Do you sort of feel the energy shift?
Yeah.
And as you're writing a set, a routine, an hour of, do you kind of shuffle the jokes around and delete and edit, and is that based on the energy or just the feeling of how hard they laughed, or how do you sense that?
Yeah, well, I mean, there's always, look, first of all, if you're doing an hour, the energy's going to go up and down, you know, as you go. I mean, you're never going to be at a 10 out of 10 for an hour straight. They've got to come down a little bit anyway, you know. It's like you're running you got to kind of pace a little bit. So you got to... you got to let them breathe a little bit and come down a little. And so there's different bits that I know, you know, are strong and kill. And I want a few of those at some, one part of the show and a few of those in another part of the show. But when I'm kind of developing in my act and new stuff and all that. It is funny how the audience will tell you, you know, but it takes a while. You've got to do a bit, you know, I don't know, 20 times maybe until you can get a good read on it, until you can, you know, because you're going to have different audiences, but so you're going to have to try it one night with an audience and it may bomb, but you may really have faith in it. And I know it's good. I just got to tweak a couple of things. And you try it again, and there may be times where you just find the right way in. You know, I've done bits, and I've been trying, and then it'll just hit me. This is the angle to take, mm-hmm. and I tweak the way in or the setup or whatever, mm-hmm. and it makes all the difference in the world. You know. But it's all trial and error. That was the good thing about, you know, back in the day, 8 months ago, when comedy clubs existed and I could go to the Comedy Cellar every night and do three shows a night. You could tell you could start a new bit on a Monday, and by Saturday I could tell whether it had a life or not. Because I've been up in front of 15 audiences already with it, you know.
I think people that don't, you know, most people don't do stand-up. People who are listening who haven't actually done this probably don't understand that you're really kind of just editing just words and pacing and like you said, the setup and that it's very microscopic, isn't it? Every little detail.
Yes.
Is that a fun process for you, or is that you know, like
it is fun. It's you know, I don't want to get too highfalutin about it or too precious with it, but it's like music. It's a bit like music.
Uh-huh.
You know, it's one wrong little note, and it clunks. And the same with words, with wording, and also pacing, and the gap you put between one word or the next.
Yeah,
it is a bit. Very minute and detailed, but
so, sort of like, you know, jazz. Like jazz, you say it's about the spaces between the notes. It's like the words
exactly,
are like
yeah. And the volume and the way you push it, and you push it a little less, and but you don't write it that way. You know, you write the bit. The thought comes in your head, and oh, that could be funny. Oh, that's a funny premise. And then I put it down, and then, okay, how do I set it up? Okay, whatever. and then you, I mean, the way I do it is, and then I take it on stage and I don't have it word for word yet. I have it kind of broadly outlined, and then I take it on stage, and I'm not winging it, but I haven't really beat out every word, and I just let it flow there, and you feel it, and you feel, oh, that worked. Oh, that was a little clunky the way I got into that or not of that, and then you do it again, and then you do it again, and then, you know, after you've done it and you've been successful with it, then, you know, the audience has kind of helped you write every little beat and every little jazz, every little moment, every little pause, you know, because you've tried it. You've tried it a bunch of times and you felt it. You felt the rhythm. You know, they kind of help you write the rhythm of it. You know, it's hard to write. You can write bits in front of your mirror, in your house and whatever, but whenever I had to do, like, if they asked me to, like, here, I'll give you an example. When Obama was elected the first time, okay?
Yes, those were ABC, the good old days.
Yeah. ABC, you know, he went to 9 inaugural balls that night and one of the balls was going to be on live on ABC. And so they asked me, would I do 5 minutes? You know, and you go on, you know, Biden goes up, you know, Obama was stopping at all these different balls. You know, there were 9 balls that night. So this was the ABC one.
Yeah.
So before, what's going to happen is he's going to go on stage and then you're going to go up and do 5 minutes, whatever. I'm like, holy shit. Well, how do I say no? Of course I'm going to do it, you know, but now I got to write 5 minutes of, you know, some material. Oh, George Bush is leaving the White House and blah, blah, blah. Whatever. I had to write 5 minutes of that specific material. And I have to just trust it. I have to trust. I don't have an audience now to tell me that this works, that works. You're going out on a limb there, you know.
Uh-huh. Haven't worked it out on the road for 6 months and tried it over and over again. Yeah. This is a new bit.
Yes.
But the president's there.
Yes. So that's the scariest thing. That's the scariest thing in the world there. To follow up on this story, it didn't go well. It didn't go that well. There were a lot of elements, you know, people were standing. Jay-Z and Beyonce were going on a stage, like, to the side, and they were setting up at the time.
Uh-huh.
It did not go well.
Oh.
And I was a little crushed, and this is I'm getting off on a tangent here.
But no, it's
this
great.
This is a cool little thing was I had only met Gary Shandling once, and that was when my wife was turning 40, I wanted to get all these celebs saying happy, but I was giving her a surprise video and somebody connected me with Shandling and he did it for me and it was great. And we exchanged cell phone numbers. That's the only time I really had met him. But we had each other's cell phones numbers for years now. This is about, Jesus, 5 years later, 6 years later. I go back to the hotel room after kind of bombing in front of Obama's, you know, on Obama's night.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, my wife was there. We're in Washington. And she doesn't know. You know, my wife's been through so much. She's like, it was fine, whatever. And I know it wasn't fine.
Uh-huh.
And my cell phone rings. And it's Gary Shandling. And Gary Shandling just telling me he saw it. He goes, those were funny jokes, man. Those were really funny jokes.
Right.
And whatever. And he you know, he knew what I was going through as a comedian. He knew, and he just had it in his heart that he wanted to tell me, you know, that you did fine. It was funny. And they were good bits. The circumstances were, it was really bad. But it was such a cool thing. You know, I don't know why.
You find yourself micro-analyzing it. To the point that maybe you're seeing things that nobody else would have seen. But about just speaking about Obama and just sort of the, you know, the gravitas of that. I mean, do you ever get used to that? I mean, you were a stand-up comedian from Queens. You all of a sudden have this incredible, not all of a sudden, over years of touring, and then you become this enormous success and this incredible success and make one of the most successful sitcoms of all time. Now you're performing with the President of the United States. And around every comedian and celebrity and Hollywood and the glamour of it all, do you get used to that?
Well, I mean, I don't know if what you're asking. Do I get nervous?
Yeah.
If I get nervous, absolutely.
Yeah.
I was terrified that night because first of all, it's like I told you, this is not me doing tried and true, proven material. This is me having to write material for this moment, and knowing as a comedian, you know. You're going to be up on a certain, this is not going to be a comedy club where people are sitting and focused and watch you. And it turned out, yeah, these are people standing in tuxes with drinks and looking this way and looking that way. So there was no idea of how that was going to go. So I still get nervous. There are still situations where I do get very nervous for, and that was one of them. And the magnitude of it, you know, blew my mind, you know, the magnitude of me being in this experience with, you know, when Obama is elected, which is, you know, just for the country, for the world, is a moment that's, you know, I mean, to think that, and it was the first year that my daughter could vote also. She had just turned 18. So, yeah, I mean, just to be a part of that, experience, it's humbling, yeah. And then I got to perform at the Kennedy Center Honors for Letterman. You know, Letterman was one of the people they were honoring, and Obama was in the audience. And that's another one where I've been through so much in my career. And here I am terrified. I'm terrified, you know. I'm going up in front of Letterman, my hero. I'm going, you know, Obama's in the, everybody's in the audience. I mean, I don't know if have you been to the Kennedy Center?
I have not, but I've seen it on television. I have my David Letterman late show jacket hanging over my chair here, though. I do have that, and I keep that handy.
Yeah.
He was my hero too. Do you remember what that moment was like when you realized David Letterman was having you on, and then wanting to produce Everybody Loves Raymond?
That was freaky. That was a freak. I mean, look, after Carson, Letterman was the guy, and Letterman became, you know, every comic that was the next goal, was to be on Letterman. And that was a time in my career, I was about 11 years in doing stand-up, and I was headlining, you know, I wasn't a heavy road guy. I would stay in New York and go on the road a little bit and headline, but then I would just stay in the city. I was making a living. I had three kids. I had three little kids living in Queens with my wife. And I don't know, I guess I was making 80 grand a year to 100 grand a year doing stand-up, which is, you know, I'm a happy man.
Yeah.
I'm doing what I love to do. You know, I'm 36 now, and comics were getting sitcom deals here and there, you know, and they were getting scooped up and getting development deals left and right also, and I wasn't. And so I wasn't disappointed. I wasn't sad about where I was in my career, but the only thing was, I was like, maybe that is not going to happen. Maybe that step, you know, the next step as far as that is not going to happen, because I had been on every show. I'd been on all the, you know, the Tonight Show, the HBO Young Comedians, this and that. It wasn't like I didn't have the exposure. People saw me out there, and no one was offering any deals. And I said, all right, so maybe it's not going to happen. And that's not the worst thing in the world. I'm still doing what I love to do. But in the back of your head, you're like, you know, I had been interested in acting. I was taking acting classes. Did you know who Joanna Bexson was?
No,
she was a
no.
She was an acting coach who specifically worked with comedians.
Oh, okay.
And I took acting class.
If you've seen my work, you would know why I don't know who she is.
Yeah. Maybe I should have given you. I should have.
Yeah, send me.
I'll give you her number.
Yeah.
But anyway, I would. You know, yes. Did I? I wasn't like Seinfeld, who famously always said, "Just stand up is what he is."